Without further ado, we have three testifiers today. Our first testifier is David Burton, a senior fellow in economic policy at the Heritage Foundation. He'll be followed by Robert, goes by Bob, McCafferty. He's an operator from North County Brewing on behalf of the Pennsylvania Restaurant and Lodging Association. So, interesting story. I was actually set to have lunch at your restaurant on Saturday, I believe it was. My son was having a basketball tournament in Grove City, and we had a break. It was too busy. Anytime we all go to lunch as a family, it's 10. And so trying to get a seats for 10 people in the middle of a busy time on a Saturday wasn't ideal. But no, it's not your fault. It's clearly mine. We should have thought through it more. But I've heard great things. And I've been there before, but I've heard great things as well about the actual lunch. Yeah. Yep, that's right. Yeah, I remember that as well. So, and then finally, we'll have Jeldon Arcilla. He's the field vice president at LifePoint Health. So without further ado, Mr. Burton, if you could lead us off, and then we'll go just straight into the testifiers, and then we'll all ask questions at the end. Thank you. Mr. Burton, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you very much. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today and talk about how you may be able to improve the regulatory climate in Pennsylvania. I normally would have been able to prepare a written statement so you'd have some of the information I'm about to refer to. I'll try to get that to you soon, but I was recently tested positive for COVID. I haven't checked the latest CDC guidance, but I'm pretty sure COVID can't be transmitted over telephone lines. So we should be okay. I want to talk about 8 different things. I want to talk about tax rates, tax levels and spending, occupational licensing, labor and employment law, zoning and land use, permitting and environmental rules, banking and securities regulation, administrative law, which is the law governing regulations and regulatory enforcement, and then some parting words on what needs to be done to actually succeed in improving the regulatory climate in Pennsylvania, or for that matter, at the federal level. First, let me just mention 2 overall things. If you look at the Bureau of Economic Analysis GDP growth rate data, which GDP translates into income and living standards, they're consistently lower in Pennsylvania than in most states. Pennsylvania for 2018 through 2021, in terms of growth rates, ranked 42nd out of all states. So you probably have some work to do. In terms of the Forbes ranking for best states for business, they ranked you 27th, which is, of course, middle of the pack. So I think there is room for regulatory improvement in Pennsylvania, and I'll talk about some of the things that you should look at. Now, spending in a balanced budget environment implies tax levels, and in terms of spending per capita, spending per person in Pennsylvania, again, Pennsylvania is sort of middle of the pack, number 26, according to the American Legislative Exchange Council. In terms of taxes, the Tax Foundation, which is a very high-quality organization in Washington, it looks at tax policy. Your state business tax climate index is 33rd overall, so in the bottom 2/5, but your corporate tax rate is particularly poor. It's 42nd out of 50. Now, I had some time to look at Pennsylvania's tax system, but not as much as I would have liked. But right now you have a very high 9% rate, but evidently legislation has been enacted to gradually drop that to 5%. 5% is a nationally competitive number, but under your current law, that won't happen for another 8 years, which is a very long time to wait to get to a competitive tax rate. Your 3%, again, I'm not a Pennsylvania lawyer, and it's possible I'm getting some of this wrong because of my illness. I've had limited time, but 3% is a reasonable number nationally and competitive. Your sales tax rate is high, but not extraordinarily high. You are good in that you have no inventory or personal property tax. Let me just take 1 second to talk about the basics of what is and is not good tax policy. The most important thing are your marginal tax rates and how your tax system affects the cost of capital, or what a business finance person would call hurdle rates. Your overall tax burden or average tax burden is less important than marginal rates. And generally what that means is if you load up the tax system with loopholes that drives rates higher, you can improve the tax system by getting rid of some of those loopholes and dropping the marginal tax rates. And then the cost of capital, which particularly affects businesses' decisions about whether to locate in Pennsylvania, will be disproportionately affected by how you treat investment, in particular your cost, capital cost recovery allowances, and whether you allow businesses to deduct the cost of their investments in a reasonable time. One last thing that you really need to review is the sales tax that's imposed on business investments and business inputs. In some states, as much as 40% of the tax revenue from a sales tax is not from consumption and not from retail sales. It's from taxing businesses on business inputs or businesses when they build a factory. And you need to systematically evaluate that. I noticed that in the Pennsylvania sales tax statute, there are taxes on structures, and but there are some exemptions. You need to look at that because that will affect dramatically a business's decision on whether to invest in Pennsylvania. It could be a 6 to 8% increase in the cost of building a factory. Another thing I thought I would bring to your attention is the unfunded pension liabilities in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania, while it's good in some respects, is extremely bad in terms of the funding of your pension liabilities. There are only 28% funded, according to the information presented in Alex's report. And that places Pennsylvania 46th in the United States in terms of pension. And that's particularly important because the numbers are big and they will necessitate future tax increases to pay for these unfunded liabilities. Occupational licensing is a serious problem throughout the country. Licensing people to requiring licenses for people who, say, arrange flowers or for barbers, it can have a disproportionate negative impact on lower income people who are trying to improve their situation. Even the Obama White House released a report identifying this as a problem. Pennsylvania seems to be among the best in terms of having a relatively light occupational licensing burden. It's something you should review, and in point of fact, your Department of State in May of 2021 did so, but I think that's one of your lesser problems based on what I've looked at so far. In terms of labor and employment law, Pennsylvania does not have a right to work statute. That is often extraordinarily important to businesses who are considering establishing large manufacturing facilities. I realize that that can be politically problematic, but it's pretty clear that that makes a very large difference in terms of attracting new businesses. But you also need to review your unemployment compensation statutes and your workers' compensation statutes and some of your other labor and employment law provisions to make sure that you're not making it unduly expensive to operate in your jurisdiction. In terms of securities and banking regulation, there securities regulation at the state level, jurisdictions fall into two basic jurisdictions. Those that are disclosure jurisdictions, which is about three-fifths of the country, where basically the law is comparable to federal law and requires people to honestly disclose the terms of the deal and to provide information to investors. And then there are so-called merit jurisdictions, which where the securities regulators, in effect, make an assessment whether the proposed security is a good deal and fair to investors, and in effect substitute their investment judgment for that of private investors. Pennsylvania, unfortunately, is a merit jurisdiction. That makes it much less attractive to offer securities there and much more difficult for entrepreneurs to raise money in Pennsylvania. One of the more famous examples of merit regulation going awry is when Apple did its initial public offering, Massachusetts, under their merit provisions, decided that Apple could not offer their securities in Massachusetts because Apple was just too risky an investment for Massachusetts citizens. So Massachusetts citizens were unable to buy Apple stock when it was appreciating most rapidly. Now, since then, the federal securities laws have prohibited states from doing that for public companies, but they still do it for that are public companies on a national exchange. They still do it for smaller companies that are traded over the counter, Regulation A companies, crowdfunding companies, and things like that. It adds expense and makes it very difficult for entrepreneurs to raise money in your jurisdiction. So you might want to consider changing your securities laws so that they're with the vast majority of states and have disclosure provisions under the Uniform Securities Act rather than merit provisions. Another thing that, nationally we have a housing affordability problem, but that's generally driven by state and local government zoning and land use restrictions that make it difficult for the private sector to build the apartments and homes necessary to have affordable housing. In most big cities, it's very, very difficult to build new housing, and the government always imposes additional costs and restrictions on builders who are seeking to build new housing. The restriction in the quantity or supply of housing drives up rents, drives up housing prices, and makes it prohibitively expensive for lower income and young people to get into home ownership. Now, there's, of course, the NIMBY problem, not in my backyard. Most people, once they own a house, prefer not to have others build houses nearby. They prefer for vacant lots or undeveloped lots to remain undeveloped. And they tend to want higher cost and single family housing instead of lower cost single family housing or multiple family housing units. But if you care about the price of homes being affordable to low income people and young people, you need to start looking at ways to ease up on zoning and land use restrictions. Something I haven't had the chance to review in Pennsylvania, but it nationally is an extreme problem, are permitting and environmental rules that make it extremely expensive and extremely difficult to build new manufacturing facilities or infrastructure. You really need to undergo a systematic review of the impact of these rules so that people can build factories in a matter of 1 or 2 years instead of decades. And the same would apply with respect to infrastructure, whether that's things like bridges and highways or pipelines. I have not had the opportunity to review healthcare regulation in Pennsylvania, but in many cases, the biggest thing driving ever-increasing healthcare costs are regulations, and some of those are at the state and local level, particularly permitting, occupational licensing for, say, physician's assistants, or restrictions on care by physician's assistants or nurse practitioners, and also permitting with respect to testing facilities like MRI facilities or new hospitals. The last substantive thing I'd like to talk about is administrative law, which is the law governing the regulatory process and regulatory enforcement. At the federal level, this would mean the Administrative Procedure Act. Most states have an Administrative Procedure Act, and that can be extraordinarily important in terms of making agencies think through their regulations rather than regulating without receiving public comment or being required to think through alternatives. You also, if you don't already have it, should have a cost-benefit analysis requirement, and it needs to be robust. On the federal level, that is Executive Order 12866, initially promulgated, I believe, in the Carter years and made robust by the Reagan administration, and OMB Circular A4. But just having a cost-benefit analysis without imposing some requirements is not terribly helpful, because if an agency doesn't want to do cost-benefit analysis seriously, they won't. You need to do what OMB has done through Circular A4 and impose rigorous requirements. But one of the biggest problems at the federal level is that the agencies do their own cost-benefit analysis. You may very much want to consider having a third party do the cost-benefit analysis, or stand up an agency to do that for other agencies. You may want to consider, if you don't already have, an analog to the Regulatory Flexibility Act at the federal level, which requires agencies to write down and think through less burdensome alternatives to the proposal. And the add-on to that, the Small Business Regulatory Enforcement Fairness Act, which requires them to specifically look at the impact on small businesses. You may want to consider the unfunded, an analog to the Unfunded Mandates Reform Act, which is basically looks at whether a regulation is imposing unfunded mandates on local governments or tribal governments or things like that. You may want to look at a state analog to the Paperwork Reduction Act, which specifically looks at information or like forms that require people to report information and imposes restrictions on their ability to force people to collect and report information unless it's absolutely necessary for purposes of enforcing the regulation. Throughout all of this, you need to make sure that there's a private cause of action to enforce noncompliance with these provisions by the agencies. That basically means that there's some consequences to the agencies not complying with these provisions, in that the regulated entities can raise the issue in court, and if the agency blew through the requirements, then the regulation is void. The last thing in the administrative law area that I might want to mention is, if you don't have something analogous to the Congressional Review Act directed at so-called midnight regulations, you might want to do that. Basically, that often at the federal level, I'm sure it happens in Pennsylvania, an outgoing administration that's lost an election will promulgate a raft of regulations at the very last minute. And this has a look-back period so that the legislature can undo those regulations through a simple resolution. Now, I thought I would give you 10 parting thoughts on what needs to be done to actually get a handle on the overregulation or the ever-increasing administrative burden being imposed on our citizens in this country, and in your case, Pennsylvania. Excuse me. First off, this fixing this problem requires hard work. Complaining won't get the job done. I personally am getting a little tired of conservatives going on Fox News and complaining about the administrative state, but never actually sitting down and learning what the rules actually do and in drafting rules to get rid of the problematic rules. The left, that while malevolent, isn't lazy. They spend years and years and years in advance of a new administration drafting rules and legislation that, so that they're ready to go. And we all need to do the same thing. And historically, conservatives have not been terribly effective at reversing the left's handiwork while they have control of government. For example, 2/3 of the Trump administration's rulemakings, major rulemakings, occurred in year four, and a very large percentage of those occurred in quarter four of year four. So a tremendous percentage of the rules that the Trump administration did to get rid of the Obama-era regulatory handiwork never took effect because the Biden administration never implemented those rules and are busily engaged in reversing most of what the Trump administration did. So we need to do the hard work so that we're ready to go when a conservative legislature and a conservative administration has power. You need to allocate responsibility in projects, learn the law and regulations, and then draft legislation and draft proposed rules to reverse the problematic rules that have been enacted by the left. You need to take to heart the fact that the bureaucracy will not help you. You need to learn how to do these things on your own. You need to start training people in Pennsylvania administrative law, training people in terms of how to draft regulations and get them through the process so that they'll survive judicial review. The bureaucracy is not going to be your friend. In contrast, when progressives take power, the bureaucracy helps them and helps them navigate the process, helps them draft rules. Your legislative counsel in the legislature will also probably be of very limited assistance for two reasons. One, a lot of the folks that work for legislative counsel are not conservatives, but and there also tend to be very young lawyers just trying to get a piece of legislation off their desk. So they do the minimum amount of work possible rather than drafting quality legislation that dots the I's, crosses the T's, and plugs the loopholes and addresses all the issues that need to be addressed. So you need to develop a legislative agenda and learn the details. You need to learn the supporting literature, the things that support what you're trying to achieve at the legislative and regulatory agenda. But this is particularly important at the regulatory level so that it will survive judicial review and not be treated as arbitrary and capricious and therefore undone in the courts. You need to create mechanisms like a Congressional Review Act or other analogous things where you can legislatively attack problematic regulations. You need to learn administrative law, the rules governing rules, and start drafting rules improving Pennsylvania administrative law now. And then you need to enlist assistance from outside groups, bearing in mind, of course, that many of these groups have interests of their own and won't necessarily be objective or pro-market or pro-public, but nonetheless, in the absence of help from the outside, you probably won't be able to get that done. An analog to that is you need to work to strengthen conservative and limited government institutions at the state level. So groups committed to freedom and limited government and conservative principles, so conservative think tanks, conservative citizens groups, and groups that will help you address these problems and come up with trusted, well-thought-out solutions. With that, I'll stop and answer any questions that you may have, and I am more than willing to help your staff and you as you move forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Burton. We're going to allow the other testifiers to testify, then we're going to ask questions across the board. But before we do that, I did want to announce the other members that have come. Representative McCurry, Representative Jones, Representative Rigby, Nelson, Stair, James, Banta. And online, Chairwoman Oberlander and Representative Cooper. Just as a reminder for those that are online, if you do have a question, just raise your hand. But unless you're speaking for a question, please remain muted. All right, on to our second testifier, Mr. McCafferty.
Hi, everybody. Thanks for appreciate your time today and your interest in getting some solutions done. Thanks, David, as well. That was great and needed. I'm Bob McCafferty. Jody and I operate North Country Brewing Company in Slippery Rock. We opened 18 years ago this past Saturday, 19th. So 18 years open. We actually started renovating the building and 25 years ago. So to tag what David said, Jody and I actually wouldn't be able to open North Country Brewing Company today with the way some of the regulations have occurred. We'd be outpriced to do so. So that does hurt mom and pa's that would like to be an entrepreneur today. But really, I just wanted to kind of tie in the hospitality industry's, current state of affairs and focus on what we're seeing today so that we can move forward together. And really, that's what the hospitality industry is about. We love our communities. We love our team. And we're always a fan of seeing everybody be lifted together. A lot of the current regulations that are being mentioned, it always seems like our industry is, there's like a negative attached to it, and then it gets fed through the media. But really, I mean, our industry lives on 6%, and that is our financial sustainability percentage profit margin. And that's only if we do everything right. So I need to mention that because that seems to be missed in the world today. That's 6 pennies off every dollar of sales if we do everything right. So, some of the regulations that feed into that would be like the time involved of my office manager trying to keep up with the added regulations every year. And also a lot of it is unintended consequences of some regulations that have come through. And we're not, against regulation. We understand we need it. I think that there's just always more every year. The tipped wage for me personally, as well as our staff, and this ties into some of the things that we're seeing, like this, the scheduling, flexible schedules is what got me through college. And I started as a dishwasher. I got rid of 3 other part-time jobs. I learned every station, was fortunate to learn under a chef. And then I kept up picking up shifts, and so I ended up being a server and a bartender. But that paid for 2/3 of my college. And what we see today are the students that come through North Country Brewing Company, and we're able to offer that same level of, they learn more of the trade, and then they increase their pay every time they learn a station from dish to saute. And it's up to them if they want to do that. We still have a lot of students at SRU that are employees. And we're happy to have them. We've had a dishwasher graduate from SRU and decide to stay, and him being him, he was just so talented and creative, he ended up being our executive chef. And so that's where a lot of the labor involved, too. We do have professional positions ranging from $38,000 a year to $85,000 a year. And again, there is a progression of a career there. Whereas you start literally just train somebody how to use a can opener. He's 23 years old. So it does start there with training for some folks, but we're happy to do it. And now they're great. They're running grill and flat top, and they've learned from that and are progressing as they're with us. So with a tipped wage, I'm a big fan of it. You know, I know it's kind of being mentioned in D.C. and Maine. The front house folks and the hairstylists had it reversed, and they maintained the tipped wage. And that's where, you know, that's how I got through school and everything, and that's how I see our employees getting through as well. So with the 6 pennies on the dollar that I mentioned, if we do waste a burger, literally to pay for that food plate cost of $5.50, yes, we sell it at $17 to maintain that 32% price point, that percentage we have to live off of. That pays for labor, broken equipment, utilities, licensing. We actually have to sell 91 burgers to replace that one burger. And I know it sounds impossible, but that is the reality of our financial sustainability of our industry. So that's where I just have to mention that part along with some of the regulations. The IRRC, you know, they're an agency that's not elected to represent, but they do have a small window of notice. They do tag on to some things that have been mentioned before, like the 80-20 rule for servers. You know, that was a 2012 mention, and now here it is being implemented. So some of us do pay attention and watch that, but, you know, when it just goes through, then it's already implemented, and there's not a big window of us to actually have a say in it or maybe mention some of the unintended consequences of that. Because that does, to me, start having us watch the front of the house employees' time more, and then that lends to be into their flexible schedule, which they enjoy because they are single parents. They're parents, they're students, they love that flexible schedule, and that's what our industry is unique that way. I mean, I used to love backpacking, and I'd come back and have a job, you know, I just gave them enough notice. So that was a flexible schedule. the FAST Act in California did take 1 million votes to get on the ballot, and that was basically have another panel decide what the rate for employees would be in California restaurants. And it was just quick service. That's how it was going to start. And I know that's California, but what we see is that actually goes to our friends in Philadelphia and their local municipality adopting some of these policies. So then you have a patchwork of policies then, and they are ever changing over there, and we feel for them. So with the Associated Health Plan, I don't want to take up too much time for you guys. I know we're running through the clock here. Associated Health Plan, that's why I have to weave in some stories, because it's just not me saying this is what I think. You know, when Jody and I opened North Country Brewing Company, we had 60 employees, no management yet, but we were happy to offer 100% coverage of healthcare. And to me, that was our business entity's perk to be our employee, and we appreciated you. And, you know, we would have a 4 to 6% increase at the time, but then the following year, it might be 2% down. And so that was doable, and we had zero deductible, 100% coverage. It didn't matter if you worked 25 hours. We had bartenders and servers on it. We had management on it. It didn't matter to us. Since then, you know, the ACA, we are now at $3,500 deductible, and, you know, it just doesn't really cover what we used to have at all. And this past September, I had employees want me to pay the fine so they could go on penny. And so then on the paperwork end of that as well, my office manager has to go back through 2 years and dig out employees that signed off on our benefits and join the marketplace. And then it's 2 years of looking back for that employee, and then it's three appeals of that for one person. And we did have some employees, even though they signed and we had a meeting, we were very clear about how that would go. You know, that is part of the regulation that I'm speaking of, is just the time and the effort on business's part to keep up with what has been already reported, actually, when it first occurred. So the Associated Health Plan, you know, I'd like to see a way where, you know, companies like mom and pop companies can actually join a plan like that. You know, some of the local restaurants near us have investors that have a large construction business as well, so that they have a better rate with all the people they have. And, you know, whereas I mentioned we had 60 employees when we opened, we were up to 220 employees before COVID hit. And we actually had less people on our plans then than we did when we just had 60 employees, because everybody doesn't want to pay what they're paying for. And we try to make the best plan and the most affordable rate for everybody, but that's where we're at. I do have to thank State Rep. Valerie Gatos for initiating this conversation about associated health plans again. We really appreciate that being initiated again. There are 14 states that do have associated health plans in their state. You know, and I think that as far as a solution would go, you know, thankfully our business is on associated health plan. There's only a few in PA that got grandfathered in, and we were thankful to get that. You know, when we had a team member get cancer and their husband was actually on dialysis, our rates went from, it went up 25% every year when Affordable Care Act started. And when that team member got cancer diagnosis, it went up 75%. Basically, nobody wanted to quote us, and we couldn't afford it. So that associated health plan that we got grandfathered in on was the only reason why we could even offer benefits right now. So to close up, like I don't want to take a lot of your time, and I appreciate your time. Some of the paperwork, you know, like there are more regulations, and there's actually more agencies requiring the same reporting on a different form. Lately, we've seen, you know, the gallons of beer we brew go to PLCB. We already report that to TTB, Department of Revenue, and, you know, there's like different forms for all these agencies now that have now, within the past few years, need more reporting. So, again, it's more on the time line of our office and that section of our industry. The U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, EEOC, and I just really have to mention this one only because, you know, this one actually would involve liability for industry or any industry, actually. My office manager actually spends 2 days deciding how to check what the employee did not want to check to be hired. So they don't have to check what they, you know, whatever sex, gender, race doesn't have to be checked. And yet we were called and were told that we had to check that box. Well, she's in the office and she doesn't know these folks. And, you know, we're not in a position to decide anything like that. So that is a 2-day operation for her and she's quick. But, you know, especially when folks came and went during the past 2 years, especially, we just couldn't keep anybody and couldn't find anybody to work. And she really is busy enough without that. But I guess those are my points. I just really do appreciate your time. And I would love to see solutions this year. And, well, moving forward would be great, you know. But, you know, sometimes it just does feel like the fee fine faux fum of it, you know, like, want to work, you pay a fee. Do anything wrong, you pay a fine. Do anything right, you pay a tax. And then the paperwork is the faux fun part. So, but again, I appreciate you. Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Ursula?
All right. Good morning. I'm Jeldon Arcelia. I am a registered nurse with over 30 years of healthcare experience. I'm licensed in multiple states and various regions across the country. I serve currently as a healthcare administrator, a bedside care provider, and also have been a patient on multiple occasions. Currently, I'm the vice president and chief nursing officer of the Conemaugh Health System, located in southwest Pennsylvania. We staff over 2,000 nurses and allied health professionals, as well as over 500 physicians that service multiple counties in the region. Our main campus, Conemaugh Memorial Medical Center, is a level 1 trauma center, a level 3 neonatal intensive care unit, and also a teaching hospital that is growing the future healthcare workers, especially for Pennsylvania. There's a long legacy there that goes all the way back to the Great Flood, Clara Barton, the American Red Cross, and rebuilding that community. But Johnstown, Pennsylvania is still one of the most underserved communities across the Commonwealth, but yet Conemaugh serves as a safety net for the region. Thank you for including me today. I'll keep my remarks brief. In your packets is prepared testimony from the Hospital Association, which, among other details, highlights the complex and often contradictory web of regulations that govern healthcare delivery in Pennsylvania. We'll focus our remarks on regulations specific to the provision of health care. But as a top employer in the 18 Pennsylvania counties and an economic driver of about 20% of the state's GDP, we will most likely concur with the many observations you received from Mr. Burton and Mr. McCaffrey on how regulation is a barrier to us. Specifically in healthcare, our current regulations can be workforce deterrents. They pose operational impacts and only delay access to care and timely services. Here's an example of workforce deterrents. Over the past 3 years, our Conemaugh School of Nursing and Allied Health Professionals have graduated nearly 200 students during the pandemic, only to have faced significant delays in getting approvals to take their state boards and also to receive temporary permits, which is a huge barrier for them in entering the workforce. In my own experience, again, during the pandemic, just trying to recruit healthcare workers from outside of the state, a majority of them, close to 70%, withdrew their applications altogether because of the extended processing times and rigid requirements required by Pennsylvania. In my own experience, just applying for my own license, it took nearly a year at the risk of expiration to be issued, and only through the advocacy and intervention of Representative Rigby's office, thank you for that, was I able to secure my own nursing license. During the pandemic, we were able to deploy healthcare workers because we were granted provisions under the emergency operations to vet our own employees and given a grace period to complete the requirements of the state. That has long since expired. But yet, even though COVID volumes and our surges seem to be subsiding, the workforce crisis sustains. Operational impacts. I wear my badge today because under former regulations, I would be wearing multiple badges. The previous requirements that each facility would require individual name badges, credentialing, and processing. We're a five-hospital system with multiple ambulatory care settings and outpatient areas, and this was very prohibitive for our own healthcare workers just to travel throughout the system that spanned nearly 60 miles in either direction. So you can see how this red tape, again, prohibits us and is a barrier for providing services to our community. Thank you, again, with legislative efforts, this law has been changed, and now we can, operate and focus our care on our patients and community. But this is definitely something we didn't really want to deal with during the height of our COVID pandemic. Access to care and timely services. And again, Representative Rigby can speak to the investment and the commitment that Conemaugh Health System and LifePoint have in putting back into the community to sustain for years to come and generations after us. We are working hard to not only renovate aging infrastructures, but also expand our facilities to provide more care and access points to service our community. Here's another example during the middle of pandemic. In what would be a normal procedure in renewing a license for one of our ambulatory surgery centers, the fact that we had to change the name or be consistent with the rest of the system put us at risk of having to close down our surgery center, providing tests and procedures and seeing patients for anywhere from 45 to 60 days until proper licensing could be granted, even though the same license was renewed a few times over prior to. You know, we're not saying that regulation isn't required. It's absolutely necessary to ensure the safety and the welfare of our patients and our communities, but we don't want to confuse it with things that aren't value added to ensure that or makes additional work for our healthcare systems. Here's another hot topic that didn't gain the traction. It's starting to move, but during our pandemic, we relied heavily on telehealth. you know, virtual physicians, nurses, specialists, especially to reduce the risk of exposure to COVID patients and to serve, again, rural regions or remote areas that don't have immediate access to healthcare providers. Not sure where the direction is going with this, but current regulations is silent on this modality and does not speak to it. In fact, vague to the point that whether it's obsolete or it's just not part of the scope, current standards can be interpreted that it cannot replace in-person healthcare physicians, nurses, and providers, which again would only result in patients in these remote and underlying areas not to be able to receive care at all. Somehow we have to be able to embrace the technology and leverage the changes and innovation in healthcare to be able to do a better job for our citizens and for our residents in our areas. So with that, I'll pause and stop here. I think my point is hopefully coming across how regulations could be a hindrance to us to be able to advance healthcare and expand access to all those throughout the state. Thank you for the opportunity for representing Pennsylvania's healthcare community today, and I look forward to hearing from our other panelists or answering any of your questions that you might have.
Thank you. Thank you to all the testifiers here today. And we're hearing common themes that we've heard in other hearings as well, and themes that are consistent with my own personal experience as an attorney for small, mid-sized companies. It's that it's not so much you don't want to have the regulations. Of course, you all care about the safety and health of your relative communities. It's that there's layers upon layers of regulations. It's confusing. It's convoluted. It's expensive. It gets in the way. There's better ways of doing it. And I appreciate you all coming here, testifying, and sharing how in your particular industries, how that is a stumbling block for moving forward, how it's an obstacle to opportunity in your particular fields. But before we get the questions to you all, I wanted to ask Mr. Burton a question. You had mentioned a little bit about Pennsylvania and the environment here and the national environment. And usually, in particular, when it comes to regulations and taxes, there's a negative connotation as it is associated with Pennsylvania. And that's unfortunate. That's something that we are working on. That's why we're having hearings like this. And I can personally attest to the reasons for that negative connotation. And it's not so much what the regulations are even asking people to do, but it's the timeliness in which we get responses from regulations, when it's permitting and how we go about that. But I wanted to ask it on the flip side of it and ask you a question regarding a state, or could you tell us, and I know this is going to vary by industry, but in general, is there a state or a commonwealth that does this right or does this better than most out there? One that we could look at and say, well, this state is getting a lot of these things right, and a place for us to start as we emulate or as we go forward. And in law school, they told me if you're not plagiarizing, you're committing malpractice. And in some regards, that's the same in the legislature. Is there a state or a commonwealth that is doing this the right way?
Well, your point that it does vary depending on the issue and the industry being regulated is accurate. But in general, there are some states that are right more often than not. And even among the states that are right, there are differences. But Florida does generally pretty well. Texas does generally pretty well. Wyoming does generally pretty well. It's a much smaller state. And, you know, there are other states that often do well. And that usually shows up in the economic growth numbers. And also the other thing is people vote with their feet. The states that are gaining population typically are the states that have a better business climate, a better regulatory climate, a better system or tax system and so on down the line. There's a report that Alec puts out that you might want to look at the trying to remember the exact title of it. Anyway, I'll give some of this detailed information to your staff. But there's also, I have citations that normally I would have put together in written testimony. That there's a lot of different organizations that rate states in specific areas, like the Institute or ILJ, Institute for Justice, has a very good occupational licensing report. It looks at 102 different types of licensing. That happens to be the area where Pennsylvania is unusually good. That doesn't mean there's not room for improvement, but but then on tax policy and pension funding, Pennsylvania is unusually bad. But in general, I would say that Florida, Texas, Wyoming, and a few other states are almost or most of the time have better policies. And it shows up in terms of their in-migration and their rates of economic growth.
Thank you, Mr. Burton. I'm glad you mentioned something about population and people leaving and moving with their feet to different states and going where there's opportunity, because we get bogged down in phrases like regulatory reform and tax reform and all these things. But really what it's about, it's jobs, it's families, it's growth. It's about keeping families here in Pennsylvania and across this region. I grew up one of seven and saw at one point six of my siblings across the United States in places like Texas and Georgia. And I think every one of us, every representative here has also seen that as well. So thank you for bringing that back home. Vice Chairman Eckert.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So we talk a lot about regulatory reform, but I think what we're really saying here is regulatory reduction, right? And you guys have all testified as to the challenges you face as it pertains to more regulations. And look, we hear from folks across the state in all kinds of sectors that regulatory reform is something that is needed. It's something that's hindering my business, my nonprofit, my school, whatever the case may be. And you're here to hear solutions. And I think we have a solution. And I'm curious to see what your input would be to this. And that solution, in my opinion, would be something like SB1, which has a provision which allows some oversight as it pertains to regulation. So right now, when a state agency or department passes a regulation, there is a process, an arduous process to go through. But it's not as easy as you contacting your legislator and saying, hey, this regulation is killing my business. It's killing my industry. How can you help? Well, you can submit a comment to IRC, and hopefully they'll hear it, and hopefully they'll consider it, but a lot of times they don't. It's just a rubber stamp, and it's moved on. With SB1, this process moves the process to an oversight function to the legislator, which allows the legislative branch to step in and say, hey, wait, this regulation goes a little too far. You know, you already fill this form out already with two other different agencies, or this is a double step. This is another step in the process that's really not needed, or this is a regulation that we haven't even consulted the industry leaders about whether or not it's important. I'm curious from your perspective, do you think that oversight process is needed in Pennsylvania so that these regulations aren't being passed without any oversight?
I absolutely think that's a great idea. I'm sure that IRC means well, but I also think that obviously you all have been elected by your constituents, and I think that you're more of the position to hear what your folks at home say, and so I think your oversight is definitely needed and be appreciated.
But from the healthcare standpoint, the industry is already one of the most regulated across the country. We're beholden to the federal level with CMS. We're a deemed regulatory body with agencies like Joint Commission that holds us already at a higher standard, meaning more defined, more measurable than at the state level. For us, the state is just another layer of regulation and sometimes contradictory. I'll share an example. For example, if a patient complains about the services they received, we are bound, again, by CMS to respond within 10 days. But yet the backlog for investigation at the state level, they're close to two and a half years following up on these issues. So again, I think for other industries, other businesses, that would be appropriate, but why not align to what the higher standards are already now instead of that extra checkpoint or the approval?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your question or your answers.
Mr. Burton, did you have a response to that as well?
I was just going to, in effect, talk for a second about regulating the regulators or oversight of the regulators. And there's a couple of things that can be done. First off, I wouldn't assume that they always have benevolent objectives. Often there's what George Stigler famously called regulatory capture, and they can be acting in the interest of special interests, not the public's interest. And secondly, all regulators have an interest in enhancing their power and their budgets, and they systematically seek to enhance both. So I wouldn't necessarily assume these people are acting in the public interest. They often are not. And there are ways to impose some oversight on them. One is obviously aggressive legislative oversight, calling the regulators in and asking them to justify their behavior. If they know they're going to get raked over the coals when they act against the public's interest, they'll be a little bit more or less likely to do so. But you need to set up institutions that govern the regulatory process so that this happens as a matter of course. One example is the Federal Regulatory Flexibility Act, where they have to, on paper, write down the less burdensome alternatives that they considered and why they rejected them, and then make that subject to judicial review so that if the reasons given are not satisfactory, a court will reverse the rule. Another that you may or may not have, but I doubt it's very robust, is an analog to the federal OIRA, the Office of Information and Regulatory Analysis. All federal rules have to be cleared by OIRA. One of the problems with the federal system is that OIRA is part of OMB, that in turn is part of the White House. It would be much better if it was an independent body, not subject to White House pressure. But for many decades, OIRA has been one of the very few voices of reason in the federal regulatory process. And establishing a clearinghouse that that forces these agencies to comply with rules, governing rules, and forces them to do cost-benefit analysis, forces them to engage in an analysis that explores less burdensome alternatives, forces them to comply with the Administrative Procedure Act, and specifically answer questions raised by commentators rather than blowing through those, can be helpful. You're all very busy. You're not going to be able to systematically review every regulation promulgated by every Pennsylvania state agency. But an organization analogous to OIRA can, and in fact, if you make it such that they need to receive OIRA clearance to actually promulgate a rule, then that process has teeth. There are ways to institutionalize the oversight process. One thing we need to learn from the left is that they're very adroit at changing processes so that things are more likely to come out their way. this is one of those areas where we need to also think about process. And that basically boils down to administrative law and the regulatory or the rulemaking process, so that agencies cannot do things that are overtly stupid without any consequences, so that they cannot blow through legal requirements without any consequences. And so that ordinary people in say the brewery business or a hospital business or a medical practitioner or a PA can overturn these rules through judicial review, and that the mechanisms are established in law for them to do so.
Representative Klutz.
Thank you, Chairman. One of our core goals in the Republican Policy Committee and our caucus is to remove obstacles to opportunity, which will help improve our ability to staff our health systems, improve access to health care for all Pennsylvanians, and help small businesses start and grow in each of our local communities, and will help generate thousands of family-sustaining jobs and help low-income and young Pennsylvanians to own a home. The Independent Fiscal Office testified to our members a couple of weeks ago that young families and first-time homebuyers are being priced out of the market and are unable to transition to homeownership because of rising mortgage interest rates and the rising cost to build and own a home. So, Mr. Burton, I want to direct this question to you. You had mentioned about land use and zoning and the cost to close on a home. I'm sponsoring first-time homebuyer legislation that would remove one barrier by exempting first-time homebuyers from paying the realty transfer tax. Mr. Burton, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on how we as a state government can remove barriers to homeownership and the added costs, especially for young and low-income Pennsylvanians, so that they can transition to homeownership.
Well, transfer, I didn't look up the transfer taxes in Pennsylvania. In the states where I'm admitted and have done business, it varies radically and sometimes by county. And they can be extraordinarily high. And you're right, that's a barrier to any real estate transaction, including first-time homeownership. But the bigger problem, I think, and is zoning restrictions that restrict the ability of private builders to build homes, particularly to build smaller homes on smaller lots and to build multifamily housing. There are often zoning restrictions that prohibit builders from dividing lots. So where I happen to live, the zoning restricted to 5 acres, right? And the that of course means that there's fewer homes. If it was a smaller, or so you could build 5 homes on 5 acres or whatever, there'd be a dramatic increase in the amount of housing. There's often tremendous restrictions on multifamily housing, so apartments or townhouses or duplexes. And these restrictions make it difficult for builders to build less expensive housing that would enable younger people or people of less means to get into home ownership without buying an expensive home with a large square footage and so on down the line. And the legislature in Pennsylvania, I think, could do a number of things to restrict the impact of local zoning. The other thing, particularly in large cities, they often do is impose conditions precedent so that a builder can't just build an apartment building. He has to build an apartment building with a certain percentage of, quote, low-income housing. So we have a situation where government makes it expensive to build homes through zoning, land use, and also building codes. And then force builders to proffer that they'll do X, Y, Z, and Q, and that makes it even more expensive. And all these rules dramatically restrict supply. And existing homeowners don't necessarily mind that because their homes go up in price. But it has a dramatic negative impact on people who don't already own homes, people who are renting, people who are young. But it also means that people leave and don't come into your jurisdictions because the homeownership is too expensive. And you see that throughout the country. I mean, some jurisdictions are just absolutely nuts, like San Francisco or New York. But I'd be willing to make a significant bet that some of your larger cities like Philadelphia and Pittsburgh do the same. And there's a lot of room for improvement, but it also means that you need to sort of get down into the details and limit the percentage of land that can be subject to these restrictions and impose limits on how aggressive the local governments can be in terms of limiting builders from multi-family housing or smaller homes like townhouses and duplexes.
Thank you, Mr. Burton. This is a very serious issue in Pennsylvania, especially in areas like the district I represent in Cumberland County, where home affordability is just not there for young people and low-income individuals. And I think one of the key components of removing these obstacles to opportunity that we talk about and to keeping people in Pennsylvania is to provide an opportunity for those people to transition to home ownership. By getting people out of the cycle of poverty, we can help people pull themselves up by their own bootstraps by giving them the opportunity to get into homes that they own, to start building equity so that they can start building that generational wealth. I think we as legislators, it's incumbent upon us to remove those obstacles and to be able to give opportunities to every American, every Pennsylvanian, regardless of their income, regardless of their zip code, to be able to have affordable housing. I'm very excited about some of these ideas. Mr. Burton, thank you, and thank you to our testifiers on talking about how we can improve that landscape and provide opportunities for everyone. Chairman, thank you for the time.
Representative James.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, gentlemen, all three. Two quick questions. First for Mr. McCafferty. I come from the banking and finance industry. That was my life before I came here. And you mentioned something called the 80-20 rule, which has a meaning for me in that industry. What does it mean to you?
Well, the 80-20 rule is basically anybody that is getting a tipped wage basically only can spend 20% of their time doing non-tip service work. It has to be 80% has to be associated with earning that tip. And that's a recent one that came through with some of the changes with IRC. Okay. And really, that's something a lot of operators were already doing the right thing. So,
okay. Thank you. Yeah, second absolutely. One for Mr. Arcilla. Sorry, no. Mr. Chairman. Usually we're only allowed to ask one question. You mentioned something about telehealth and then moved on to a different question. Now, I'll use myself for an example. I had a good doctor back home who changed places, and I went in to see her, and they said, well, she doesn't work here anymore, but you can still connect with her via UPMC's telehealth organization. I didn't particularly care for that. When I go to a doctor, I want a warm body, and I'm wondering how this is working out for your organization.
I think what we learned from COVID is that when we had folks sheltering in place, what they were doing, not only were they not coming into the emergency department for fear of COVID, they weren't going to their doctors, they weren't going anywhere to maintain their primary care. We were able to leverage the technology to see them to continue visits at home, to set up remote monitoring if needed, so that if they were to get in trouble, whether they sought the help or not, we could proactively get them into the next level of care. again, it's by no means replace. You come into the emergency department, the physician needs to lay eyes on you, hands on you, and make sure everything's okay. But a segment, another underserved segment we have, is behavioral health and mental health. So these folks don't necessarily need somebody, you know, physically assessing them, but in order to decompress our emergency departments and our other, you know, county facilities and so forth, we need this ability to be able to see physicians at a higher level so that we can get them the best course of treatment they need.
So you see it expanding then?
Absolutely.
The surface.
Absolutely. Okay. And not just to make mention of the compounded workforce crisis we have. We don't have enough physicians as it is. So any expertise we can reach out to, and same thing, talk about regulations, and not to get off on a tangent, but our mid-levels, our nurse practitioners, our physician assistants, they are not practicing to the highest level of their competencies, their skill, and their licensure as in other states. So in, again, rural settings or places where they don't have physicians necessarily, that's all you have, but they're limited in what they can practice and what they can prescribe and treat for patients.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Banta.
Thank you, Chairman. Gentlemen, thank you for being here. my first comment is for Mr. McCafferty. Some good friends of mine up in Erie, Pennsylvania, just south of Erie in Venango, Cambridge Springs, are the Sprague Brewworks and Sprague Farm Brewworks.
They're great people.
Yes, they are.
Yep.
Real close friends of mine.
Nice.
So I remember the day that they said they were going to open up a brewery, and it ended up being an amazing adventure. You know, 20 years ago or something like that. I'd have to look up the date.
Yeah, they're very creative.
Yes, they are. They're good friends of it. They Brian quit his job after a while, and they went on full time. And the adventure has gone like this. I've watched it, and thousands of people have showed up. I've been there and did a lot of fun things there and enjoyed it.
Nice.
During COVID, when things kind of went south and there were so many rules and regulations and it just shut everybody down, after it, they said, we're done. And I said, why? And I'm just, you know, constantly bugging them every time I go there, every time I talk to them, why are you shutting down? And they said, it's just what you're talking about, the rules and regulations that they have. So I asked Minnie, get me a list of those. And she did. And I don't have one with me today, but there's like 25 things on that list that indicate just exactly what they had to deal with, i.e., whatever, all the rules and regs is alcohol and having an establishment, paying the music to play music, all these things down the line. It was like 25 things, and I used it on the campaign trail. And so I fully support what you're doing down there. I hope to come down and see your establishment, and I will tell them that I met you.
Right on, yeah. Well, welcome all the time, and love to have a pint with you.
Yep.
But there is that many, you know, CSAC, BMI, and ASCAP. I mean, that's three. If you have bands at all, that's three people you pay, and as well as the band. But it's a shame that they decided to close up. But they do have an independent spirit about them. And I think that the mandates and the ups and downs of the past 3 years was just they're not alone. A lot of people just had enough. And unfortunately, they are more ma and pa-oriented folks.
Well, I haven't given up on them, and I'm hoping some youngster will go in there and, you know, fire it back up.
Right. Absolutely. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Arkilla, for you, I have recently visited in my district all the fire halls that I can. And so my question to those guys was, you know, what do you guys need? And they said, well, we just don't have the manpower. We don't have EMTs. I said, why don't you have EMTs? And they said, well, the federal test is different than the state test, and 7 out of 10 other guys fail it. And I can't think why that should be a problem. Why don't we just have a state? Why is it federal that they got to follow, i.e. that something in California that has nothing to do with their area, they're kind of – so anyways, that was their thoughts on that. And so my question would for you would be, how can we fix that? And also, in your perception, being in the field, why are so many people, why you need physicians, EMTs? Why across the board do you not have the manpower you need? Thank you.
So again, I'll as I alluded to earlier, if we were to have alignment with regulations at the federal level and not have another layer at the state, and when it comes to fire, even at the townships, at the boroughs, they have different requirements as well, too. There's just too many hoops for our firefighters, first responders to jump through. I won't gloss over the fact that there's a national shortage, there's a global shortage of workforce, not only in healthcare but in all industries. But as I testified earlier, how can we make it easier to enter the state for one, and two, to keep and retain our talent here by not having to go through the additional steps that necessarily don't align with what's required at the national level?
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Rigby.
Thank you, Chairman. Mr. Arzilla, thank you for testifying today. Conemaugh Health Systems, Conemaugh School of Nursing, both are and have always been huge assets to my district, to Johnstown, to Cambria County. And pre-pandemic, I know that we would see a lot of your graduating nurses coming to our office with job offers but not having their license yet. And I don't know what the holdup was. And then pandemic hit, and post-pandemic has even gotten worse. So I feel your pain there. And I did want to address the telehealth Representative James had mentioned. Knowing a lady, one of your first patients, I believe, that was treated, knew her personally, with the robot, where the doctor who was not on site was on his way in, was able to look at it on his computer, diagnose it and treat it pre-stroke, and instead of being post-hop for at least a week in treatment, she was discharged the following morning with no side effects, no ill effects, because of telehealth, because especially when you look into the rural areas, we don't have the doctors, and it's a real asset to those facilities where a doctor can look at his laptop and see what's going on as the computer screens and scans that patient, gives the diagnosis, and then he heads to the hospital. That treatment, had it not started when it was, or when he would have arrived 45 minutes to an hour later, would have been too late for that patient. And she, again, was discharged the following day, and to this day with no side effects. So telehealth it's an up-and-coming thing. I'm sure there's horror stories, but I can only talk of the positive that I know that happened to a personal friend of mine, and I'm glad that Conemaugh has that in place. Thank you.
Representative Slagle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to our panelists. My question will be simple, and you don't need to take a lot of time. But I am kind of curious. I just read a letter this morning, about 4:30 this morning, from a nurse talking about the shortage of nurses. And Mr. Archella, I heard you mentioned that when you came to Pennsylvania for your licensing, that it was really a slow process. So my question is this: could you please just briefly describe at least one of your frustrations or obstacles that you encountered?
Sure. Before entering the state, I had to do a federal fingerprinting background check with the FBI. Entering the state, I had to do another fingerprint, two sets of fingerprints, and then the required education for the state as well. I was granted a temporary license, and that should have lasted for 1 year, but I should have had my permanent license long before that. But the validation process for every state to certify that I was in good standing, every school, every education, when already I was appropriate to practice in those states, still another layer of red tape and bureaucracy. And it's not inexpensive. It's expensive to apply to work as a healthcare provider in the state. So that's another obstacle for new entrants.
Sorry you had to go through that. Thank you for sharing. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, and thank you to all the representatives and testifiers that were here today. We do appreciate your testimony. We very well may be reaching back out to get additional information as we go about finding more of these obstacles to opportunity. And one thing that I think has been made clear over the course of the last number of hearings is that the status quo in Pennsylvania is unacceptable. We're seeing a mosaic formed, and each bit is showing a picture that is not a pretty picture, whether it's tax issues, whether it's regulatory issues. You know, and it's all coming together to show and tell the story as to why people are leaving, why our families aren't staying here in Pennsylvania. And if we want to change that, and I would submit that we do, we got to get serious, and we have to stay away from just the padding of the status quo that we've seen in Harrisburg. And so I appreciate you all coming here and giving your testimony, and we are going to get on with our day here, and thank you again. Meeting's adjourned.